So as we're looking at this in the study, the series study on wisdom, today's topic is simple, and it's just the problem with immaturity. Because these young men didn't have the experience or the knowledge or the wisdom to correctly advise Rehoboam. So on the one hand, we have Solomon's advisors who observed the king's wisdom and who had probably been by his side for all those years. They would have given great counsel, and I believe they did. They had also observed all his experiences, the change from a king who, despite his riches, followed the Lord exclusively to his eventual idolatry and downfall. They had some insight as to why the people were asking for a lighter load and how to best gain their favor and loyalty. Remember, what they were trying to do was to gain the favor of the people so that the kingdom would stay together and Rehoboam would rule over them, even though they perceived that maybe it would be a lighter burden. You know how those things go. Politicians haven't changed, have they? They promise you the moon and they give you nothing. But might I dare say they had acquired some wisdom from serving as Solomon? I believe they did. Contrast this with the young men who grew up with Rehoboam. Their experience was quite different. Their experience was less objective, more subjective. They were the benefactors of Solomon's favor as his son's boyhood friends. Who wouldn't want to be friends with Rehoboam? His father was the richest man in the world. Tell me there wasn't favor. You know? Tell me there wasn't ice cream every day after school. Tell me there wasn't vacations paid for and favors and all kinds of things that everybody else would drool over, you know? You know this is what's happened. They saw the glamour of being friends with the king's son, and they received favor, they received honor, and riches through it, no doubt. Their experience was primarily one-sided. They were the benefactors. They didn't understand that there was a great burden on the people and a taxation on the people as far as daily duty and work and all of that. They were just privileged. So it shouldn't surprise us that they would, in their ignorance, suggest dealing harsher with the people. And even Rehoboam knew this and asked their advice because he also had the same perspective on life that they had. He sought them out. The result of the seeking wisdom from those who were immature cost Rehoboam the kingdom. That's it. You can argue that was God's promise, yes, but it didn't have to go that way. And it didn't. And God never said that it would be under Rehoboam, necessarily. He just said his sons. So I know one thing from the scriptures, that when we obey God, he says over and over again, if you will obey me and stick to my word and do all the things that I have said for you to do, I will bless you. But when you depart from that, watch out, because things are going to change. And even Jeroboam, who God gave those 10 kingdoms to, he gave him a warning as well, and he failed miserably in that and eventually lost what he had. So the problem with immaturity, and there's an outline in the back of your bulletin that you can fill in the blanks and hopefully gain a little bit more insight into this. Based on the scriptures that we're looking at here, this is not exclusive, but based on this scripture that we're looking at today in First Kings chapter 12, the problem with immaturity is that it draws upon limited experience. It draws upon limited experience. We need to gain wisdom from this and understand that we might be in those positions of having limited experience in something, and it's going to change how we view something and the wisdom that we are able to exact in that position. Immaturity is not bad, okay? We do expect it. Everyone at one time is immature. Most children are immature, right? We understand that they have not experienced much yet. But immaturity is the expectation of youth, but it's also the bane of the aged. Those that have been around for a long time, we would expect that they would have much more maturity, not immaturity. And yet, we have youth that display more maturity than some adults. Because it's not a matter of just age. It's a matter of experience and learning from what we experience. And so what we should want to see is more attention given to fostering maturity that leads to wise decisions. In our Christian circles, there are many people that want to only do one thing, protect their children from every outside influence that they can. And as good and honorable as that is, if you isolate them, you reduce the experiences that they have to draw from, and eventually they become children just like Rehoboam's friends. Limited experience, unable to cope sometimes in big life decisions. We want to give our children an experience of understanding what life is like. It doesn't always pan out the same way, but I know from experience that when we allow our children to face consequences of actions, they learn something, don't they? But if we shelter them from it all, they won't learn anything. So, if immaturity draws upon limited experience, then there are a few things that we could see to help us develop maturity, not only in our children, but in us as well. Experience is a great teacher, especially when it deals with our failures. Experience is a great teacher, especially our failures. You'll notice that there has been a different philosophy that has been permeating our society, as well as our classrooms. We don't want anyone to feel left out. We don't want anyone to fail because it'll damage their little psyche, okay? So we're moving away from giving awards for achievement, recognizing people who have done better than others because we don't want anyone to feel bad. It's everywhere. I see it all the time in my grandkids in the way that things are presented at school. I remember the other day, my granddaughter Lily, we were talking about something, and I don't know how to say it. Well, all right, so my grandson Creek is running around the house, and his pants are falling off because his pants are like probably 12 inches longer than his legs because the kid's built like a linebacker. I don't know if you've ever seen him. So he can't get a waist size big enough unless he gets the pants that probably fit a 12-year-old. I don't know the way to say it. We roll him up. But he's playing all over the place. And suddenly, he's appearing to everybody like he's in the plumbing business. So you get where I'm going with this? Okay. And I said, hey, pull up your pants. And Lily turns around. She says, hey, don't judge Papa. And it's like, and she didn't mean it disrespectful, but it's what she's been learning in the classroom. Anything you say to anyone about anything, any kind of criticism, is judging. See, that's the philosophy of the world. So I just quickly said, I said, pardon me? I said, are you telling me something? So, no. You know, I look at her with those bugging eyes, you know, and I said, honey, I'm not judging. I'm just stating a fact. It's like, we need to be able to state facts. And then she asked some questions, and we worked through that with opportunity. But our philosophy today is off the charts. We don't want to bruise anyone's ego, and so we're not allowing anyone to face any consequences, which could be a great teaching opportunity. What if failure makes us more determined to succeed? Really? All right, so let me give you a couple of examples. I'll read these to you. As a young man, Abraham Lincoln, we all know who Abraham Lincoln was, right? What was his greatest achievement? What was he? What was his position? Anybody know? President of the United States. Okay. And, well, today that may not hold as much weight as it did back then, but let's put ourselves back into the 1840s, in 1850s. This was a big position. But listen to this. As a young man, Abraham Lincoln went to war as a captain, and he returned as a private. How's that? Wait a minute. Don't most people that go off to war, they do something great and they get promoted? He started as a captain. He came back as a private. Afterwards, he was a failure as a businessman. As a lawyer in Springfield, he was too impractical and temperamental to be a success. He turned to politics and was defeated in his first try for the legislature. Again, defeated in his first attempt to be nominated for Congress. Defeated in his application to be commissioner of the General Land Office. Defeated in the senatorial election of 1854. Defeated in his efforts for the vice presidency in 1856. And defeated in the senatorial election of 1858. At about that time, he wrote a letter to a friend saying this, quote, "I am now the most miserable man living. If what I feel were equally distributed to the whole human family, there would be not one cheerful face on the earth." That's the man that became president. We would give him counsel today. It's like, give it a rest, Abe. You know, it's like, really. It's like, how many times are you going to do this? How many times are you going to do this? Winston Churchill, I think most of us know who Winston Churchill was. He repeated a grade during elementary school, and when he entered Harrow, was placed in the lowest division of the lowest class. Later, he twice failed the entrance exam to the Royal Military Academy at Sandhurst. He was defeated in his first effort to serve in Parliament. He became Prime Minister at the age of 62. He later wrote, "Never give in, never give in, never, 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 in nothing, great or small, large or petty, never give in except to convictions of honor and good sense. Never, 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 never give up." Those failures taught him something, didn't they? And we all know Thomas Edison, don't we? Thomas Edison's teachers said he was too stupid to learn anything. These are the people who are in charge of raising up children who have educations and have insight and said he's too stupid to learn anything. I guess the light bulb didn't go on in their mind. No pun intended. He was fired from his first two jobs for being non-productive. As an inventor, Edison made 1,000 unsuccessful attempts at inventing the light bulb. When a reporter asked, "How did it feel to fail 1,000 times?" Edison replied, "I didn't fail 1,000 times. The light bulb was an invention with 1,000 steps." What does that say about us? That failure is what drives us to succeed. And through that, we learn much wisdom. Where would we be today if these three men had not persevered instead of listening to what the populace says today, give up? That's for us to take away from. We really need to have a better perspective of what it's all about. So immaturity draws upon limited experience. Secondly, the problem with immaturity is it can be a result of privilege. This is what we see in our passage with these young men that grew up with Rehoboam. So many today have been the benefactors of a cushy lifestyle, and they know little or no hardship. The generation that came out of the Great Depression accomplished more in America than probably any other generation because of what they experienced. When everything is handed to us, we stay in an infantile state. Privilege is a weakness that makes the ineffectiveness of the church today to be what it is. The American church is ineffective because we have been granted much privilege when we compare it to the rest of the Christian church in the world. Every generation of Israelites that lived in prosperity, check it out through the Old Testament, just read, go through Judges, go through Kings. Every generation that lived in prosperity and favor raised up another generation that forgot about God. It just keeps repeating itself over and over again. It's like, how many times, God, do you have to keep showing this to us? Why do we have to keep seeing, you know, they're following the Lord, they're not following the Lord. And God has to keep bringing prophets and bringing problems in their life to get them back on track, because every single privileged community produces a spoiled community that forgets all about God. It's no wonder that the millennial generation in this country today in America, by far the largest percentage group, is the least Christian of any generation. Because that philosophy that we've been talking about has permeated their culture. Privilege is the way that Rehoboam and his peers grew up. Privilege is the way many of our kids grow up. Do we see the similarities between these two? And what about ourselves? Is our own privilege, because of maybe ethnicity, wealth, position, family, etc., preventing us from reaching spiritual maturity? In many ways, it does. And one of those things that I have said to you, in whatever privilege you may have, something may have lit a light bulb or struck a chord in your heart, and maybe it wasn't a good one. Oh, here we go again. We have a bad attitude about life in general, and we are very poor Christians as far as reaching the communities around us and reaching people as a whole, because privilege really prevents that. The young men who grew up with Rehoboam lived a life of privilege, as did Rehoboam, and it greatly affected their ability to render a mature and wise decision. In similar fashion, we see privilege having the same effect today. America is a privileged nation. Don't forget that. Don't forget it. Ask anyone who has ever been outside of this country, and they'll tell you absolutely we are privileged. Rich or poor makes no difference. It really doesn't. Because if you're poor in this country, you're still better off than nearly 90% of the world's population. When people in this country call themselves poor, they have no idea what they're talking about, because the limited experience that they have seen puts them in a privileged position amongst those of the world. They don't know what it's like to go without the basic necessities of life. There are a few here and there, yes, but for the majority of Americans, it's pretty good. We complain because we have to pay taxes. But at least we make money to pay taxes. In some places, taxes are required when there's no income. In some places, there's just nothing. No opportunity, no food, no shelter, no anything. I'm not going to bring up the politics of our nation into this, but there's two sides to every coin. There's two sides to every coin. And as much as some of you, I'm just going to say it, may be, and you may look at the immigration problem and you may have a certain idea about it or opinion about it, I've sat down with people who have broken into this country illegally. And I got to tell you what, if I was in their shoes, I'd do the same thing. I would not want to live in El Salvador being hunted down by gangs or the police. Both are corrupt. I would look for the place that I could bring my family. I would look for a place of freedom. Remember this, unless you're an American Indian here today, No American Indians? Nobody related to any Massachusetts senators in here? Okay, sorry. All right, so I made it funny. No American Indians, so guess what? You're all immigrants. Just saying. Just saying. My ancestors went to Quebec, Canada, 1624, off a boat from Paris. They stayed there many, many years until only three generations ago when one of them decided to come to this country. My wife's grandfather came over here from the Ottoman Empire. She doesn't even really know what her nationality is. Many of you, only one or two generations away, came over to this country. Just think about it for a second. Compassion? Yeah. You want justice? Yes. Do we want things done right? Yes. We're a law-abiding society. But just remember, our experiences limit our wisdom in these ways. We are still, in this country, better off than most of the world. I hope it stays that way. I love America. I love the privilege that we have in it, but it has also taken away from our spiritual maturity. We don't see things the same way that others do. And lastly, the problem with immaturity is that it is solidified or codified by or with arrogance. Arrogance is when we put ourselves above somebody else, when we think that we're better than someone else, when we begin to look at ourselves in favor and less favorable on someone else. Arrogance. Arrogance is one of those sins that just stops us right in our tracks. We will not grow. We will not mature because we're right. You know, Rob, thanks for your testimony this morning. I really appreciate that. And you know, in 35 years of marriage, I wish I could say that, you know, I've learned not to be arrogant with my wife and you always give the benefit of the doubt. And no, I'm not. In fact, even this morning before we came here, I shared with Michelle what I was going to be talking about, and I just got all uptight because I didn't like the questions that she was asking me. And I told her where I was going to be giving this illustration on this third point about arrogance, and she looked at me and she said, "You're being arrogant." And I was. You see, it's a battle. And it's something that we really need to harness and we need to get a hold of. In many ways, she's right. I stand in a position here where, you know what, it's very different for me to be right here in this room because you're not arguing with me. And I'll shut you down the minute you open your mouth anyway. But at home, I can't do that. It's like I want a pulpit at home. That's what I want. When we have a conversation, I want to have a pulpit. Just let me preach, will you please? We can be arrogant. Arrogance will keep us right where we are in an immature way. So despite the immaturity of the masses today, there is still an expectation of growth. The strategy for our discipleship must not be only to look at a biblical perspective on everything, but also there needs to be growth in an intellectual and an emotional way. Maturity is not just Bible knowledge. It's growing in our understanding and discernment because in so many ways we have to make decisions that we just can't open the scriptures up to and find that very topic talked about. It's never usually a black and white answer. Many times it is, but not usually in situations that we have to exercise discernment over. There's principles applied from God's word that we learn over time. There's experience that we've seen and we've gone through, and those are the things that we use to make a wise decision. And wouldn't it just be so much easier if God would have just given us an answer for everything? We could just look it up and it's like, there it is. Oh, look. You know, we don't have to worry about it. But God gave us a brain. Remember those things? Yes. They're here in the cranial area. Some are not. They're just not. Some people spend a lot more time sitting on their brains than using the ones that God gave them. When Christians do not mature, they stop growing altogether, and arrogance really helps to just solidify that whole thing. And the arrogance adds to this demise more than ever, because we just never move out of this position. Arrogance says that I'm better than this situation or problem. And so the decisions I make will be unwise in a larger scheme of things because I put my own importance over what is right. This was Rehoboam's problem. And the friends that grew up with him, they knew this. My friends, arrogance is the poison of maturity. Arrogance is the poison of maturity. And unless we mature, we will not exercise wisdom. Does that make sense? If we're arrogant, we'll stay immature. We will never learn. We will not experience the things that we need to experience. I've been talking about this recently. We'll even pray to be taken out of situations that God would be using in our lives to make us more mature in Christ so that we can give true wisdom to somebody else who needs it. I don't know that really in the Christian churches anymore. I'm not speaking specifically about us. I mean, how about the Christian community as a whole? I don't know that we're actually giving the right counsel or wisdom anymore in different situations. We're kind of losing our perspective. Everything's on the table today. And so I want to give you a little example here this morning. It's something that's been in the news. I struggled whether or not how much of this I would give or not. And I hope my unbridled opinion doesn't come forth. I have an opinion on it. Everybody has an opinion on it. But I want to bring this to your attention. You may or may not know about it. The name Andy Savage, does that mean anything to you? Recently, it was right on the news the other night, first time I saw it. It's been all over the internet, it's everywhere. Andy Savage is an author, a pastor, co-teaching pastor at High Point Christian Church in Memphis, Tennessee. And got up the other day, last Sunday, got up with his pastor, Chris Conley, the lead pastor, and made a declaration to the church because it just came out. See, 20 years ago, Andy was a youth minister on staff at Woodlands Parkway Baptist Church near Houston, Texas. And his job was to minister to youth. And part of that responsibility was that he was supposed to have no contact with any students or anyone privately. But he broke the rules. That's by his own admission. What came out this week is not just an accusation of a sexual nature and a sexual assault that is not unfounded. It was actually codified by his own admission that he did this in 1998, 20 years ago, way past the expiration time for this. The statutes I've run out. No criminal charges can be pressed. But this girl that came forward gave her name. She had contacted him over a month ago by email. Remember me. There was a lot of injustice done with her, not per se by Andy only. And yes, I don't want to minimize what he did, but I also don't want to use it to crucify him either. He's a brother in Christ. But 20 years ago, 1998, when he had an opportunity to do the right thing, he didn't do it. And so this is the way it's come out. It's all over the news. If you don't see it, go on the internet. Put in Andy Savage. You're going to have two pages of hits before you can even get to his bio page. He was supposed to give this girl, Jules Woodson, a 17-year-old, he was 22-year-old, on staff, a ride home. She was the last one at the church left. It was dark at night. She didn't have her car. He was driving her home. When he got to her street, he went past her street. She asked him, "Where are you going?" He said, "You'll see." The girl's messed up. She was messed up then. She had confided in him for emotional problems that she had, sexual abuse by a family member. She had confided in him. And this young man, at that time, 20 years ago, decided not to drive her home, but to drive down a dirt road someplace in the middle of nowhere, pulled around and asked her to perform oral sex on him, which she did. Confused, thinking she was in love, not knowing what was going on, he jumped out of the car, went to his knees, apologized to her, begging her to take it to the grave. She didn't do that. What most people don't know is they think that she just resurfaced 20 years later. She didn't. She went to the pastor of the church, the head pastor, and told him what took place. They said they were going to take care of it, but they didn't take care of it. The leadership in the church did not take care of it. So here's where it really begins to get strange, because there's an opportunity to do the right thing, to exercise wisdom, and wisdom wasn't exercised. So instead, they tried to sweep it under the carpet. Right there at that time, the associate pastor, Larry Cotton, who was now a pastor with Austin Church in Austin, Texas, big church. Some of these guys have moved all over the place. They're actually pastoring some of the largest churches in America, or co-pastoring. Said to her, when she described what took place, he said, quote, "And so you were complicit in this?" Immediately turning the tables on her, that she was the one who instigated it. This wasn't something that just happened because she was flirting. He planned where he was taking her. It was a place that only he knew of, and he did this. And she was in his care, somebody who was emotionally fragile already. So he preyed on her. Now, big mistake. And he didn't wait until the act was finished. In the middle of it is when he jumped to his knees and got down and begged for her forgiveness, but a little too late. You see, that church didn't want to deal with it. But Miss Woodson told her Bible study girls' class what took place. And it began to spread throughout the church. And so in 1998... Woodlands Parkway Baptist Church, which is now that's not the name of the church anymore, they decided that they needed to get Andy out and to send him off to another ministry. And they gave him a going away party. Never told the congregation what took place, only that an incident had happened. The gossip went around the town, basically believing every lie that everyone said. By the time Jules Woodson graduated that year, this was spring of her senior year, she left the town never to go back. Some years later, a couple of years later, the pastor contacted Miss Woodson's family and asked if it would be okay if they brought Andy back on staff. The family didn't even know what took place at that point. All the details said absolutely not, and they didn't. But he went on to be the youth leader at some other church and found his way to Memphis, where he is still on staff, but as of Friday, on a leave of absence. The act was criminal. It wasn't just a sin. It was a crime that the church covered up. Chris Connolly, the lead pastor of High Point Christian Church in Memphis, knew his background because Andy had told him when he came in, still made him co-pastor and went ahead with it. When all this hit the fan this week, the church again tried to minimize what took place. In an article by Ed Stetzer in Christianity Today, just 2 days ago or yesterday came out, Ed blasted the church, and I'm glad he did. Ed's the president of Lifeway Christian Fellowship, and Ed said, because when they brought him up before the church, I think that's an appropriate thing to do, but the way the whole thing was staged by Chris Conley, the lead pastor, they really didn't do justice to what took place or say exactly what took place. The church gave them a standing ovation last week. Ed Stetzer in Christianity Today said the standing ovation was disgusting and a blot on Christianity as a whole. That's his position. That's what he wrote. I'm glad that Christianity Today took a stronger stand on it. Here's the thing. You may have your opinion, you may think this or that. I have seen a lot of ministerial friends go up in effigy in a blaze of fire in the same things. Sexual things. I've seen pastors that have led family conferences every year. One particularly just leave his wife and shack up with a young girl in town. No one could convince him. That's his prerogative. He did, and he left the ministry, obviously. I've seen other pastors that I've known, personal friends, one particularly in a church not too far away, years ago, made sexual advances to a teenage girl in the church, building those relationships and then taking advantages of them, never really admitting all that he had done. His wife divorced him, the church threw him out. He's not in ministry today. He doesn't need to be in ministry today. He's a friend. I see him. But he doesn't need to be in ministry. He abused a position. Look, in my opinion, the arrogance that was displayed by the pastoral staff, both churches, was the very poison which solidified immaturity, leading to a very unwise decision. This thing should have been dealt with years ago. There could have been healing for Jules Woodson and Andy Savage. Andy went on to get married and raise five boys. He's got five boys under the age of 14 years old. He's written books. I told this to George this morning. He's written books on manhood and family. How do you write all those things when this is hanging over you? That you know that he thinks about every night. The Bible says, be sure your sin will find you out. None of us are above that. I'm not, you're not, none of us are. But listen, the issue is not forgiveness. Should Andy Savage be forgiven? Absolutely. Should you be forgiven for whatever sin you commit? Absolutely. This is not the issue. The issue is not time. Well, that was 20 years ago. What does that have to do with it? You got 20 years of getting of messing up a life. This girl is a wreck. But I also think, because knowing the human heart and knowing as a Christian how I feel when if I have unconfessed sin, he's had 20 years of hell hiding it. That needed to be released a long time ago and been dealt with. But the shenanigans that the church has pulled because of unwise decisions caused it to be bigger than it ever was. The issue is not time. The issue really here is not even restoration yet, because there's been no penalty. There's been no answering for what's been done. Can he be restored? I'll let you think about that. But listen, why is this such a big deal? It happens to people all the time. But the Bible clearly tells us that in the position that we are in as an elder, there's a higher standard to maintain. 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. I think we got it up there, do we, Jim? Or do I only have it? Now we do. This is a faithful saying. If a man desires the position of a bishop, that's an elder, he desires a good work. But he must then be, what's that first word? Blameless. Now some can take that way too far. We've seen all degrees of this, and churches coming down on decisions left and right that in some ways don't make any sense. We're not talking about just sin. We're talking about a crime. A crime and sin. Is he blameless? No. It's really hard. It's really difficult. My opinion, Andy Savage should have got up last week and said, I'm sorry, I'm resigning as co-pastor of this church. Should have resigned. Because our pastors are the ones that most of our church people are looking up to. And the kids that we're raising within the ranks of the churches, they are looking up to them. And they put them up on a pedestal. And they give them all, even in this day and age and everything that is taking place, they still put a lot of confidence in them.